developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is, but doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to "the world is one family." In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere after fleeing Myanmar. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The inflation rate in Italy has been high for a while, breaking record after record. An increasing number of Italians are struggling to make ends meet, fearing that the cost of living pinch could soon turn into pain. The National Bureau of Statistics recently announced that the prices in the country rose more than 8% year-on-year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in 37 years.
It is impossible to continue this way. Gas and electricity bills have more than doubled, and the cost of bread and milk is going mad. This is pure madness.
Italy's annual inflation rate in December dropped to 11.6%, down from 11.8% in November, but the cost of living crisis keeps biting businesses and households hard. High energy prices caused by energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war is the main factor contributing to this surge.
The immediate loss of this situation has been the collapse of purchasing power by over 10%, which translates to the net loss of one monthly payment for employed workers. People on low income wages, such as employees and workmen, which represents 90% of the labour force, are among those suffering the most.
Analysts believe that a combination of high inflation, rising interest rates and a lack of fiscal support will push Italy and other EU economies into recession.
Month after month, life is becoming increasingly tough. My retirement payment went up 50 euros 2 months ago, but the cost of living has increased by 200 euros each month.
Life is more expensive for those who live on one income only. The cost of renting houses, buying clothes for our kids, food. I can't see how we'll be able to face all this.
With the aim to fight high inflation and put prices under control, the European Central Bank has raised interest rates. The move is likely to hamper the European economy further. Some ministers in the Italian government have strongly criticized the ECB over its aggressive monetary policy that they believe could raise the prospect of recession. Max Civili, Rome.
A
A mass rally has been staged in the Yemeni capital along with several other Yemeni provinces called Al-Hisar Harb Alayna, which translates to "The siege is war upon us." Yemen is experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in history due to what protesters call the U.S. and Saudi Arabia strangling blockade on innocent civilians. Demonstrators called for an immediate end to the blockade and the ongoing war.
We came out in this blessed protest to tell the aggressors and their allies that their blockade is a war on us. Therefore, we, the Yemeni people, say if you do not lift your blockade, we will certainly teach you a lesson you will never forget. We will not sit back and watch our people starve to death.
We came out to deliver a message to the world that we will no longer remain silent on this aggression, war, and blockade on our people.
Yemen's military spokesperson reiterated this week that if the Saudi-led coalition fails to lift the blockade, the Yemeni army will have no choice but to use military force to break the siege. Protesters in Sana'a expressed that it's time to use the military card, since the Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea.
We came out today to tell our military forces to go ahead and strike the capital cities of our enemies so they can be forced to leave the blockade by the will of Allah. Only then they will live in disgrace and humility.
The protest comes after a week of violence stemming from the continuous Saudi shelling in the northern province of Sada'a, which has killed and injured dozens of civilians over the past 2 weeks. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia continues to seize and detain Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea, preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah and unloading the much-needed fuel supply.
The Saudi-led coalition attacked Yemen in 2015, declaring they would defeat the Ansar Allah movement and their allies within a matter of weeks. It is now 2023, and they have not achieved any of their goals. This, as the Yemeni government based in Sana'a continues to advance its military deterrence capabilities. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
St. Pancras Station, one of London's biggest and busiest. But not today. A 48-hour strike by train drivers, preceded by another 48-hour walkout by other rail workers, have meant travel misery for thousands. The dispute between ASLEF and the RMT Rail Workers Union on the one hand, and the employer Network Rail and train operating companies on the other, is largely over pay and the impact of inflation on workers' wages. The disagreements have kept a deal elusive for months.
Well, we want to hear movement on the issue about some of the conditions they've put down in Network Rail. That's a restructuring of all our members' terms and conditions. And it's a similar recipe in the train operating companies. They've gone for a thing called driver-only operation, which we think is extremely unhelpful. We can't accept that. And, of course, we'd like an improvement in the pay offers.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has so far refused to meet with the unions to try and hammer out a deal and has instead vowed to get tough on the strikes. His government is also accused of trying to turn public opinion against the strikers. But there's no sign of that happening yet.
I think workers are well within their rights to demand at least living wages to be kept in line with inflation. So, yeah, I'm fully supportive of this.
I really sympathise. I think they're right. So I'm not mad. It's inconvenient.
The UK economy is experiencing the combined effects of Brexit, the war in Ukraine, and its effect on energy costs, as well as inflationary pressure on the post-pandemic recovery. And rail workers are not the only ones complaining.
ASLEF and the RMT are two of the UK's most powerful unions, able to bring their railway service to a standstill during industrial disputes. And the concerns they have been raising about the difference between people's pay packets and the cost of living at the moment are shared by many different industries and professions.
Nurses, ambulance drivers, teachers, postal workers, driving examiners and the like all have pay deals with the government in the pipelines and are likely to be offered less than the rate of inflation. And that means the UK's winter of discontent is likely to drag on. Saeed Puriza, London.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022. Humanity Eye Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue.
Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansar Allah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's described as the most right-wing cabinet in Israel's history, and sure enough, it is living up to that description. The coalition cabinet of Netanyahu is taking extreme steps against Palestinians and its institutions, from ordering the flag of Palestine to be taken down, to sanctions against the PA, to the storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to Palestinian prisoners and their conditions. Well, the list is rather long. All of this is happening in a matter of a couple of weeks' time since the beginning of 2023, when the cabinet members were actually sworn in. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at all these extreme moves, also deemed illegal, and look at what this means for the future of Palestinians and Palestine. First, let me introduce our guests. Mohsen Nafi, human rights activist, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is Brett Jonkers, historian and journalist, who joins us from Hasselt, Belgium.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will start with you, Mohsen Nafi, and let's take a look. It was rather easy to actually come up with the questions because there have been so many, on so many fronts has this right-wing extreme cabinet members to have gone out and to have made good on their pledge of cracking down on different Palestinian issues. So let's start with issue number one, in no order of importance. And this is the issue of withholding money. Millions of dollars, as it was announced by the finance minister, in tax revenues will be withheld from the PA. And the reason they gave was because of that UNGA vote, of which it was recommended by the PA for the for Israel to be referred to the ICJ, International Court of Justice. Of course, this is a big deal for the Palestinians who are already striving hard with their daily lives in occupation and under an apartheid regime. Tell us what you think about this move by the finance minister.
Well, this is what was expected out of this new cabinet, this new right-wing fascist cabinet. And they're doing exactly what they had propagated during election time, that they will really try and enforce as much force as they can upon the people of the West Bank, especially the Palestinian Authority, and that's exactly what they're doing. $570 million of tax deductions have already been made since 2019 to 2022. And the $40 million that they're reducing right now that they have claimed that they're making is actually money that is used as a stipend for the innocent Palestinians in the West Bank who've been either killed or who've been injured by the Zionist regime. So this is clearly an attempt to further weaken any kind of power that the Palestinian Authority has within that area. And it is certainly an attempt to weaken any kind of resistance that the West Bank is enforcing upon the Zionist regime and to really weaken them psychologically, especially financially as well. So it is that attempt. New Year has started. The cabinet just came in power. This is the kind of trend that they're setting. This is the tone they're setting to the new year, that we're not here, we don't advocate for a two-state nation, we're here to weaken you. And this is just, it's very symbolic as well. And it's an attempt to retaliate to the fact that the UN has referred the case of Palestine to the International Court of Justice as well. So it is an attempt to also silence the PA.
Sure. Well, you kept mentioning the word trying to weaken, and I wish that word was used, or that approach was used by this right-wing cabinet and its members. But let me ask you, Brent Jonkers, what you think of the statement made by the Israeli finance minister on this topic, where he said, as long as the PA encourages terror and is an enemy, what interest do I have in helping it continue to exist? Adding, the PA will have to decide if it wants to continue existing. You see, there's a difference between trying to weaken the PA in this case, or putting it into the question of its existence, which sounds like that may be their objective, is it?
Absolutely. The entire concept of a two-state solution, as is so often loudly trumpeted, of course, by the West in particular, but also by countries that often claim to be for a negotiated solution, and in the past has also very often been the official line taken by the Zionist government itself, this two-state solution is a lie, and it has been a lie since the very beginning. All the way back to even when the Oslo Accords were signed in the 90s, there is absolutely, when you really look at the facts that that have existed since then, you can see that the Zionists were never planning at all to abide by the rules, by the agreements that they themselves forced the Palestinians to sign and to agree to. What they want to do, what Zionism wants to do, what Israel wants to do, is nothing less than the complete eradication of Palestine as a nation. Not necessarily by exterminating all Palestinians, but definitely by subduing them and by forcing them to exist either as second-class citizens in their own country or by forcing them to basically leave the country, by ethnically cleansing the land from the Palestinian population. So when the finance minister of the Zionist entity says that he is basically threatening the very existence of the state of Palestine or of the Palestinian Authority, as it is often called, this is basically a threat that cannot be taken lightly. And of course, now he says, okay, if Palestine wants to continue to exist, they have to abide by the rules that we set out in Tel Aviv, and then they will continue to exist. But we know Israel has been doing this since 1948, that they constantly keep pushing the lines of what is socially acceptable. They keep pushing the borders, keep pushing the envelope of what they demand. Originally, they demanded just a nation for the Jews to exist in Palestine within the 1948 proposed treaty by the United Nations. Then they went further, occupied more land. And now they have been, since 1993, they have been occupying illegally areas that even Israel recognized as being Palestinian. And now we're talking about even pushing even further. And they're basically talking about putting forces in Ramallah and completely demolishing any semblance of Palestinian statehood and Palestinian autonomy.
Well, they're going based on a map of what they want to do, a shot list, if you want to call it, because it's rather in quick succession and in rather warp speed, if you want to call it that. And most of that, we just move on to the next topic, which is prisoners. Now, there are a couple issues over here. One, the far-right minister, Ben-Gavir, has scrapped a rule allowing lawmakers to visit Palestinian prisoners. Now, I guess he's going back to some older protocol from what I'm understanding here, where a lawmaker from each faction is going to be allowed to visit the prisoners. First of all, why do you think he's zoomed in on the prisoners? And what do you think about this law that he, at this point, has scrapped?
I think the focus for the prisoners is mainly because of the attempts that the brave prisoners in these jails have made to leave and to escape from these jails. That's one reason. Another reason is that this is another way to pressurize the Palestinian Authority, to show them who the real boss is, to show them who really is in power. It's an attempt to really weaken the Palestinian Authority, and I agree with what you said, not just weaken, but to literally exterminate the existence of the Palestinian Authority, and with that, the agreements and the accords that were signed with the Palestinian Authority as well. But this also kind of goes on to show, and this is also a lesson for the Palestinian Authority, the PA, that to have any hopes for a two-state solution, to have any hopes to be able to work with the Zionist regime, were false in the first place. The call for a one-state solution in which Christians, Jews, and Muslims can live together was always the right stance to take. And now, with this new regime, it's the real motives of the Zionist regime are really unleashing, in which they don't really care for a two-state solution. Anyone right. who claims that they do is it's a false claim in general. And this prison issue is an extension of that exercise to really weaken and finish whatever empowerment that the PA had.
Indeed. Well, there's another issue about prisons as a whole, Brent Yonkers, and it came to light when Ben-Gavir visited. Ben-Gavir, we keep talking about him, but it seems like he's at the forefront here. So that's why I keep bringing his name up. He visited a new prison called Nafha, if I'm pronouncing it properly, of which he said that I'm visiting this new prison to make sure that the Palestinian prisoners are not living in conditions that are comfortable, that doesn't suit a comfortable environment. Now, this is what's interesting. Let me see if I can get a quote from him on this, of which, according to one particular piece of news, it says that he wants to ensure that the murderers of Jews are not getting better conditions as a result of the construction of new cells. I'm not too sure what to respond to that, which is what I'm asking you. First of all, the whole idea of a new prison, doesn't that show the weakness of the cabinet or Israel as a whole, that it has to build a prison because it's imprisoning Palestinians, of which what? Israel breaks international law, but yet Palestinians are the ones that suffer. And then for him to come out and say that about the prison conditions, what do you think?
I think there are a few very important words in that. And very importantly, there is the concept of killer, that he's talking about the killers of Jews. He's not talking about murderers or terrorists in general. He's talking about people who he considers to be killers of Jews. And this is because Zionists, and especially nowadays, in ever since the rise of Likud, this pseudo-religiously sort of justified Zionism, they consider Jews quite literally to be superior human beings, or even above the concept of human beings. And in consider Palestine.
Brett Yonkers, hold on to your thoughts. Hold on to your thoughts, Brett Yonkers. We're getting cut off intermittently, so we're going to get right back to you while we fix that. So I'm going to come to you, Mohsen Nafi, on the issue now of flags. And this was another eye-opener in the long list of these actions that are shocking actions, to say the least. Again, Ben-Gavir, ordering the removal of Palestinian flags from public spaces. That in itself is really, truly shocking, I'm guessing. Of course, your reaction matters. His reason, he says, it's an act in support of terrorism. And he says the flags needed to be removed by what he calls the occupation police and also soldiers, because additionally, it's a threat to public order. What do you think?
Well, this is exactly what was expected from this new cabinet. This was exactly what was expected from a narcissist like Ben-Gavir. He's someone who the Israelis even aren't a huge fan of. This is an individual who has attacked the local police for not taking enough action against Palestinians. So before he came to power, he clearly said that we don't want any Palestinians in the West Bank. He clearly said that even Israelis who are in support of Palestinians, we don't even want them in the West Bank. And it is quite clear that these are the steps that are being taken. I mean, removing flags from the West, from that area is exterminating and finishing the actual identity that the Palestinians have. If cabinets like these will remain to stay in that region, the Palestinians will lose the very identity that they have. The Palestinian flag is a representation of their struggle for freedom. It's a representation of their culture and the right to freedom. And really to hit on that is also a plan to provoke the Palestinians to retaliate and react. And it is quite
very important
obvious
point
that the resistance forces will retaliate and they will respond to these acts of crime, because they aren't just an act of crime within that region, but they are also a violation of their accords, their contracts, and the UN as well.
Sure. Okay, hopefully, Brent Ankers, we have a good connection with you. If you can go ahead with your statements prior, if you can go ahead with that, please.
Yeah, I was pointing out that by the minister's statement, referring to the Palestinian prisoners as killers of Jews, I think that's a very important point, because we have to bear in mind that the Zionists, and especially the pseudo-religiously justified Zionists that exist in the government now, they have this existential view of the world, of this conflict as a sort of almost spiritual existential war, in which they see Jews as a superior race and Palestinians as an absolutely inferior race to them. For people like Ben-Gavir and in general, the Likud and the religious right in the Zionist entity, if you can call them religious, for them, this is not just a conflict between two states or two nations. For them, this is a sort of existential issue. What they want to do is they want to push on for a form of completely exclusionary settler colony of Eretz Israel, as they call it, Greater Israel, to occupy as much land as possible and to completely get rid entirely of what they see as these inferior goyim, these non-Jews that live in the land that they claim as their own. And that is why, for the minister, it was so important that Palestinians are not, quote-unquote, comfortable in prison. They are not, in his opinion, they shouldn't just be imprisoned. They should be dehumanized. They should be mistreated on purpose in order to have their dignity as human beings taken away, because they are considered to be the enemies of Jews and standing in the way for this sort of Jewish exclusionary racist state that they want to found for what they consider to be the superior people.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Last week, or maybe a little bit longer, I'm not sure, but roughly about a week or so, Mohsen Naqvi, we had the Al-Aqsa violation that took place by, guess who, Ben-Gavir, who stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, of course, and that really brought a lot of reactions. It was, I'm not going to say surprising, because there should be that type of reaction, but in the volume and the manner that it came through, based on a date or 2 days after that, of which it culminated in a UN meeting, it points again to another important topic that the minister felt had to be addressed. And it even is said that it went against Netanyahu's warning, whether we can believe that or not. But he did storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, even though the UN meeting did not, even though it convened, but it did not do anything. It did not come out with a statement condemning Israel in terms of a resolution. Not that even that matters, but at least the effort could have been made there. So when you take a look at the different violations, not violations, but the Al-Aqsa violation and the other points that we just talked about, I'm guessing this is not a thing where they sit down and say, okay, so today I'm going to go to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or let's talk about Palestinian flag removal. This has to be a systematic train of thought that's being executed in rather quick speed. Are we looking at the fact that they want to move ahead real quick with trying to eliminate the Palestinian identity and, in turn, Palestinian foothold in their homeland?
Well, I think these acts, these provocative acts, will only make the resistance forces stronger. And when the resistance forces will become stronger, their foothold within that region will increase and not decrease. So this is clearly a calculated mistake that this new cabinet is also making. And it's quite believable that Netanyahu must have warned Ben-Gavir not to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because it is a grave mistake. The kind of reaction that was that the international community gave to this act was overwhelming. All members of his forces united and gave out a clear statement that Jerusalem, that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is a red line. And if that red line is crossed, there will be severe retaliation. The reason why they're taking these extreme steps, the reason why they planted an extremist fascist like Ben-Gavir in that position, which had never happened before, which has happened for the first time, is because for the first time they're seeing resistance forces similar to Gaza within the West Bank. They're seeing that Palestinians in the West Bank are reacting and are resisting in different ways. This is all a way to put that pressure on local Palestinians. This is all a way to somehow get a provocation out of them so that in an attempt to exterminate them from that region so that they can have a Zionist state like they had all this planned. But it's quite impossible. I think all of these attempts will fail. The resistance forces will become stronger, and they will answer to these provocations in force.
Brett Yonkers, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, prisoners, removal of Palestinian flags, also looking at, and for lack of time, we couldn't get into how he has also barred the construction permits to the Palestinians. I think what is happening is that you're having a situation where, based on one particular analyst, since I'm not one, of what is happening on the ground, is that the pressure that's being exerted, it's like a pressure cooker situation that's already compounding a very tense situation on the ground where these ministers are pushing for an explosion, okay? And all the issues here that we discussed are pointing to that direction. And then the question that is asked is, what this explosion is going to look like, nobody knows. Is that a correct assessment? And if there were to be an explosion, what are we looking at in terms of a reaction coming from the Palestinians?
Yeah, well, it's of course hard to see to say in advance exactly what is going to happen, but I believe we're definitely looking at a sort of new third intifada situation. And I think important is when you indeed talk about the Zionists really putting up the pressure and blowing this to a boiling point, the question is why? Why would they take all this risk when they're already basically in power? And I think it's important to know that despite all their boasting, there is a big existential fear that exists across the Zionist entity, which has been expressed by top intelligence officers such as the former chief of the Shin Bet, whose name I have forgotten, unfortunately, a couple of years ago, who said that demographically speaking, the Zionists are quickly running out of the demographic power within Israel itself, let alone within the Palestinian territories, quite simply because of the fact that they're running out of basically Zionist settlers and they're not reproducing quickly enough to really demographically take over the Palestinian population. And they are faced with the problem that if they just leave things the way they are, the Zionists are afraid that eventually the Palestinians will quite simply outnumber them massively to such an extent that they can take their country back. So the only thing they can do now, in their opinion, is basically to resort to extreme amounts of violence in order to really escalate the situation into total war, and then hopefully for them, in their opinion, hopefully their military superiority in terms of technology and weaponry will win the day. Uh-huh. However, in reality, I think we will see when this third intifada breaks up, when the forces of resistance really take over in Palestine against the forces of appeasement that have ruled since 1990, we will see in the end, inshallah, in Palestinian victory.
We'll see. Time will tell. Thank you so much, Brett Yonkers, historian and journalist from Hasselt, Belgium. And Mohsen Nafwi, thank you, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikaba Tahwai and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we discussed the liberation of Khorramshahr and the events related to this great juncture in the history of the Islamic Revolution and the 8-year Holy Defense. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon Imam Khomeini's ideas about the status of women in society. Stay tuned, please. One of the important issues which had occupied the minds of combatants and thinkers during the struggles against the despotic regime of Shah in Iran was the clarification of the status of women in society. Imam Khomeini was always asked by journalists on the position of women after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The father of the Islamic Revolution always tried to clarify the Islamic view, an approach towards individual, social, and political rights of women. He considered women as the core and axis of the family units and believed that if woman succeeds to achieve high grades of knowledge and spiritual and ethical values, she will be able to train children and keep the family climate more successfully. This will lead to an advanced society. The Imam was of the opinion that women's presence in family and their impact on men and children determines the course of society and the movement of mankind toward perfection and sublimity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly condemned the instrumental look of the Shah regime to women, which had trivialized them into the means of pornography and promiscuity. He would always support individual and social freedoms of women, but never agreed with turning them into the tools of meeting the carnal desires of libertine men. Imam Khomeini always called for serious and active participation of women in various scientific and cultural arenas. He said, "The Islamic culture is oppressed, and you ladies should be engaged in scientific and cultural fronts like men." Imam Khomeini's unsparing support for education and progress of women in scientific fields was quite clear in his family and personal life. While many traditional and religious strata were opposed to education of women, the Imam permitted his wife to acquire religious sciences and modern sciences. He would even help Ms. Saghafi in her courses. Ms. Saghafi says, "After receiving the diploma of the sixth grade, I went to Badriyeh High School and studied grade 7 there. And 2 months after starting grade 8, I chose a private teacher for French language. When my father left Qom for Tehran, I studied Jama'ul Muqaddamat with him for a while. Jama'ul Muqaddamat is the preliminary book for the students of seminaries. After marriage, Imam Khomeini would teach me. After a while, he told me that I needed no teacher as I was talented." Imam Khomeini strongly defended women's participation in political and social scenes. He maintained that the victory of the revolution was the result of the efforts and self-sacrifices of ladies. However, he believed that women's social and political activities shouldn't become superficial and ceremonial. In view of this, he vehemently opposed the special bill during the Pahlavi regime, which would give women the right to vote. As a matter of fact, the Imam was not opposed to women's right to vote. He rather considered the move to deceive people, as in those days, even men had no real right to vote, and it was only the nominees, dictated by the Shah, who could enter the parliament. Imam Khomeini would say, "Islam intends woman and man to grow. Islam has liberated women from the miseries of the era of ignorance. Islam wants to preserve women's status and respect. It wants to give position to woman to end being a tool." According to Imam Khomeini's thoughts, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women's social and political rights were recognized in the constitution, and many women have participated in various posts for the past decades. Presently, a notable number of the MPs are ladies, and over 60% of university students are girls. In the first years of the Islamic Republic, some backward and short-sighted persons disagreed with women's social and political participation. But Imam Khomeini stood against them and promoted the issue while preserving women's status and dignity. The Imam's wife says, "One day I heard that the Imam had sent a message to the Iranian nation and stressed that it should be read out by Ms. Maryam Riazi on TV. There was an argument on the reason for Imam's emphasis. Everyone would say something till Ahmad said, 'The main reason is to remove the problem that had occurred on IRIB.' The IRIB president says that some of the anchors were ladies and Ms. Riazi was one of them who had been an anchor since pre-revolution. She was the best female anchor. The social atmosphere in those days was against employing female anchors. But as male anchors were needed in the battlefronts, the IRIB was in shortage of anchors." Imam Khomeini had heard the issue and said that women can do the job.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.